Today, in honor of National Gun Violence Awareness Day and the start of Wear Orange Weekend, people around the country are coming together with a simple message: there's more we can do to end gun violence. Each year, Every Town for Gun Safety and a broad coalition of partners call on Americans to wear orange and recognize the more than 90 lives cut short by gun violence every day, and to demand action toward a future free of that type of gun violence. Join the movement by wearing orange today, June 1st, and post your pictures online using the hashtag WearOrange to show you're committed to ending gun violence.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 1st, 2015. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. I'm so casual today, I'm not even wearing a collared shirt. I think this happens maybe twice a year. Not even a soft collared shirt. A V-neck! And to celebrate that, we have the politics editor of Splinter News, Alex Perrine, in studio. He was like, what? No soft collared shirt? I'm coming into studio.
I didn't get the memo. I dressed up.
Also on the program today, comedian Jake Flores, who had a, we had briefly mentioned this a while back, a visit from ICE officials because of a tweet. We will talk to him as well on the program. Donald Trump starting a temporary trade war with our allies. Meanwhile, Donald Trump pardons Dinesh D'Souza and is looking for more felons who have committed the same crimes as him to pardon in the future. South Carolina Boeing workers vote to unionize. Federal prosecutors are caught hiding even more hours of video, 50 hours of video, from the defense in the J20 protesters case. These were the protesters who were anti-Trump protesters protesting during the inauguration. The IRS head says Trump cuts will destroy IRS's ability to help taxpayers. U.S. adds 223,000 more jobs, unemployment drops, but wage growth lags. Also, Trump probably leaked the numbers to his friends. Meanwhile, a Texas shooting victim's mom talking to Trump is like talking to a toddler. And abortion is almost totally effectively outlawed now in Arkansas. And the Chicago privatization of parking meters story just gets even worse. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Have we done the wide shot yet? This is our first opportunity to do a wide shot. Alex Perrine is in studio with us. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Am I in a wide shot right now? I've never been in a wide shot.
You're on the very corner of the wide shot.
You're in a wide shot now, Alex.
Right in the wide shot.
We're still working out the specifics of it, but we will get there.
It's a
now,
big shot.
Jamie is not with us today, so it's like a sausage fest in here. I guess is what we call it, right?
That's what I call it.
That's sure, what Matt called it. So this is fun. Apparently, some tapes have come out. They've been, I guess, leaked. I don't know if that would use that. They have been provided to NPR between Michael Cohen and former Daily Beast reporter Tim Mak. And apparently, this is Mac, who I guess works for NPR now, that's I guess where the tapes came from. They were his personal tapes. He wrote a story for the Daily Beast where he basically pulled up an account from the book Lost Tycoon, The Many Lives of Donald J. Trump. And basically this is the story about when Trump allegedly raped his first wife and violently assaulted her. I think this was because she had said something about his hair. And then he grabbed her hair or something to that
effect. She sent him to a surgeon.
Well, the story was he was recovering from a scalp. He had a surgery to move his scalp.
Yeah, and, he had that scalp reduction.
And then supposedly, she mocked him over it, and that's when he assaulted her. That was the story, yeah.
So Michael Cohen gets word that Tim Mack is going to write this story up, and this is what apparently he had more than just the job of paying off former mistresses. He also had the job of trying to intimidate reporters. But I got to say, I mean, let's play this, but I'm going to give him like B minus. go. Let's listen.
I know where you're going with it, because the Daily Beast and yourself, you're a bunch of disingenuous bastards. And mark my words from today.
All right, pause it for 1 second. We should go back. Because it's sort of hard to understand what he says. He says disingenuous bastards.
No,
it does not pronounce
disingenuous bastards.
Bastards. Because I'll tell you, here's the problem with that, just to start off with. If you're on the other line and you don't figure out what he said after disingenuous, you can't hear the rest because you're still trying to figure out what he called you. Mm-hmm. So
the rest of it doesn't land as well.
It doesn't land as well because you're still caught up with like, did he just call me a disingenuous biscuit?
I understand you're trying to threaten me, but if you could speak more clearly.
Biscuit?
It's like being interrogated in Israel.
Call me a disingenuous biscuit? What the? All right, so go back here.
Where are you going with it? Because the Daily Beast and yourself, you're a bunch of disingenuous bastards. And mark my words from today. Today will be the day that you will regret. I know where you're going with this stupid story, and I know what you're planning on doing. Mark my words for it. I will make sure that you and I meet one day while we're in the courthouse, and I will take you for every penny you still don't have, and I will come after you, Daily Beast, and everybody else that you possibly know. Do not even think about going to where I know you're planning on going. And that's my warning for today.
Michael. Besides the warning, do you have
substantive
comments that I can include in my piece?
I have no views because there's no story.
Okay.
You write whatever you want, but rest assured, like I told Univision and like I told everybody else in the past, you could certainly look it up online. I swear as God and my children, I will
pause it for 1 second. You know what I also
so
noticed?
Not
like,
intimidated by
well, this. It's not just that this is not intimidating. He has the weirdest diction. I swear as God on my children. You don't do it that way. You swear to God on your children. It almost sounds like he wants an out. Like,
yeah,
it's
well,
not
I was
going to
say,
really
man, he's
serious.
Creating a loop. I'm not going to literally swear on my children.
If I was God, I would swear on my children.
Children. I will find you, I will serve you personally, and I will be nothing but happy when I turn around and I get a judgment for defamation against you and the paper you work for.
That is the weakest threat. Like, I feel like I've been much worse to just like, I don't know, the FedEx service people. Or
you
just
enunciate
like,
bastard, clearly.
Yeah, you got to enunciate everything, and I don't know. I found that to be rather weak tea. Not a great job with that.
Well, I think the tip is when the reporter's like, yeah, I got it. You'll ruin me. Do you have any comments for the story?
That was good. Yeah, that was like good on Tim Mack's part. It was like very... like.
And I'll tell you, when there was that silence... The thing that Cohen should do is you don't fill the silence. You make Tim Mack do it.
Yeah.
So that you can go off on something. But
it's awkward when there's silence. So then I'm going to be, if I was God, there wouldn't be silence. You bastard.
I think we can all agree on one thing, though. Window treatments is one of those soulless adulting terms for something necessary but boring as, well, you know, beep as bastards. Your blinds, you don't even think about them unless you move with your break. Alex, mm-hmm. Do you have any type of window treatments in your house?
We got these wooden shutters that came with the... We're in the garden apartment of a brownstone, so we have these very nice little shutters.
All right, it makes a big difference.
Yes, it does, yeah, it's very nice.
When they're right, everything in your home looks better. When they're not, everything in your home looks horrible. But let's be honest, taking the time to pick out and buy blinds sounds expensive, kind of boring, and installing them yourself...
Impossible,
particularly if you're of the specific people. Yeah. I'm not going to say you're who. Not going to name any names.
Dyslexic with good impression.
Blinds.com makes it really easy for you. You're not sure what you want or where to start? With Blinds.com, you get a free online design consultation. All you got to do, you send them pictures of your house. They send back custom recommendations based upon like the colors in your apartment, the style of your apartment or home, your furniture, whatever it is, specific rooms. They'll even send you free samples to make sure everything looks as good in person as it does online. And, of course, every order gets free shipping. And here's the best part. If you screw up when you measure, or maybe you pick the wrong color, but it's really it's the measuring that always screws you up. Because, measuring is tough. If you screw up, Blinds.com will remake your blinds for free. They've made it super easy for you. There's no excuse to leave those mangled blinds up in your apartment, having it look all crappy-like. For a limited time, get up to 20% off everything at Blinds.com when you use the promo code MAJORITY. That's Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY for up to 20% off of everything. Faux wood blinds, cellular shades, roller shades, and more. Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY. Rules and restrictions apply. And folks, don't remember that today, in honor of National Gun Violence Awareness Day and the start of Wear Orange Weekend, people around the country are coming together with a simple message. There's more we can do to end gun violence. You show your support by wearing orange and posting a picture using the hashtag WearOrange. Orange is the defining color of gun violence prevention movement, and each year, every town for gun safety and a broad coalition of partners call on Americans to wear orange for National Gun Violence Awareness Day. You can recognize more than the 90 lives that have been cut short and hundreds wounded by gun violence every single day. It also is a call to demand action toward a future free of gun violence. Join the movement by wearing orange today, June 1st, and through this weekend. Don't forget to post your pictures online with the hashtag WearOrange to show the world you're committed to ending gun violence in every community. You can also go to Everytown's website, www.wearorange.org. That's wearorange.org to find an event for Wear Orange Weekend of Action. Together, we can stand up, speak out, and wear orange to raise the awareness about gun violence. All right. Now, do we need to take a break? We don't, because we have Alex in studio. Alex, a formal welcome to the Majority Report.
Thank you.
Can we also turn the air conditioning? Is it getting warm in here? Yeah. Put a little AC on. All right. So, Alex, a couple of things in the news I want to talk to you about, and then we'll get to maybe some clips and stuff like that. But
cool.
Sort of an insane week this week. Sort of the I don't know what I would call it. The contrast between finding out that nearly 5,000 Americans died in Puerto Rico. And we don't know the exact figures. But this is from a study from the New England Journal of Medicine that predicts, I think it was around 4,500, people have died in the wake of Hurricane Maria. And, the news coverage basically being about, Roseanne and Samantha Bee.
Yeah.
We're basically doomed, right? I mean, is that basically it? Is that the,
yeah, it's hard to look at this week and be optimistic and come away being like, I think things are going to turn out great.
I mean, on some level, and I guess, you know, where I want to go with this is that, I mean, I think that, you know, that is the two biggest stories of the week. I mean, in terms of like, I think the headline and news, I mean, we have a little bit of this trade stuff that's happening. The most interesting thing that happened, I think, in terms of this trade stuff is Trump trying to renegotiate NAFTA, and there being basically an ultimatum that Pence issued, which caused at least Canada to say, forget it, that this sunsets after 5 years. And what's interesting to me about that is that it's the first indication that Trump's that he's being highly political, in the sense that I want to rephrase that, because I don't think that came out correctly. But that to me sounds like, okay, Pence basically said to Trump, I mean, maybe it's possible that Trump doesn't know what sunset means. Mm. I mean, it's possible he doesn't know what the implications of it are.
Right. Did you know that sunset is not HPV?
Well, I mean, they could have said
it
to
sunsets.
Him, like,
it's if, not like if, HIV.
If the Iran deal had sunsetted, it would have been much better. And he goes, well, then sunset it.
Yes.
But it sounds like there was some type of happy medium that was achieved, which was... we'll do this for 5 years,
yeah.
So that it's going to cover through your reelection, through the first year or two of your reelection. It's going to work in terms of what you want to project, and then we'll revert back to the thing that we like best.
Yeah, then we'll just go back to the way it was. Yeah,
I mean that's. I don't know why I find that so interesting or atypical of the Trump. Of Trump politics.
Well, my impression with him has always been that the one thing he actually is sincere about is trade policy, because that's been the thing he's been consistent about since the 90s, practically.
Right, and you're using policy loosely, we should
say. Yeah, of course. Yeah, right, yeah, because he has a very sort of strange idea of the economics of it, that it does not, like, economists on the left and the right don't sort of recognize his ideas as having any validity, but he's been consistent about it for a long time. So it does seem like either this is a bamboozling, like you were sort of saying, like either they're like, all right, we'll let you have your way for a few years, like, and then we'll just go back to normal. Or it is like him, like, actually acting the way everyone who insisted he actually had some sort of political sense assumed he would act once taking the presidency. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's almost sophisticated. Yeah. But it's the question is, who's it coming from?
Right.
I guess it's really, I mean, because if it is coming from the Republican establishment, there is some sort of sense of like, okay, this is how we're going to work with him. Mm. Everything's going to be temporary. It's not going to be meaningful at all.
Yeah.
And there's no way. I mean, the idea would be, right, that I guess American corporations would just simply say, like, okay, this is the way it's going to be, but in 6 years out, we're just going to do 6-year plans now. And I guess Canada is a little bit more sensical and said, this is going to be impossible to navigate because we don't know what's going to happen going forward.
Yeah.
I mean, the Republicans seem to be more confident that there's going to be some stability with the American political system post-Trump than anybody else does.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the Canadians are probably more correct on this. All right. All of this is, though, you wrote a piece this week that I want to talk about, because it sort of talks to about a broader question. It also, there were two other pieces that sort of caught my attention this week. One was by Jonathan Chait, and the other one was by Lefitz, Eric Lefitz. Both at the New Yorker. And they're all three are related in some way. New York Mag. But all three are sort of related in one way. I mean, it is either a bad idea on how to fight Trump or just sort of like bad execution. Mm. So let's start with yours about Chuck Schumer, because this just walk us through the piece and then let's talk about it in a broader sense.
Yeah, sure. So Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader. In the Senate from the great state of New York since the 1998 or 99. So, you know, with like what we were just saying, with all of the news that, all of the bad news going on in the world, there's any number of ways the Democrats could, sort of try to get headlines for themselves and their efforts to fight against Trump. And Schumer last week, after first with Nancy Pelosi putting out a good idea in a newspaper op-ed for a program to raise a federal program to raise teacher pay and school resources. He just did that in an op-ed, no press conference. The next day, he calls the cameras for a press conference at a gas station in Washington to stand outside the gas station blaming Trump for high gas prices. And
classic politics.
Yes, no, exactly.
Chuckie Schumer.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
here's a photo that you put at the top of your post.
Yeah,
it is Chuck Schumer standing there with Dick Durbin, and who is that? Also,
is that Barbara from Maluski? Or excuse me, the woman from Michigan. Michigan. What's
no, Stabenow? Is that Stabenow?
No.
This is from. She was from Delaware or
no? She's from Michigan. Debbie Stabenow's from Michigan.
That's not Debbie Stabenow, I don't think. Well, the point is, the reason why it's difficult, tell us why it's difficult to place it.
Because that photo at the top of my story is from 2006, when Chuck Schumer, in advance of the 2006 midterms, held a press conference outside a gas station in Washington to complain that George W. Bush was responsible for high gas prices. So here,
it'll work then, it'll work now.
Here's a photo from last week. I didn't have the rights to use this photo, and I couldn't find a wire photo that I could use because no one cared. There were a couple photos out there, but like none of them that we had that we, but hardly any. He got no coverage for this. A lot of people didn't know Chuck Schumer did this last week, which is maybe a sign that your political stunt failed. The only mention it got in the New York Times, his hometown paper, was in the middle of a story about how oil prices were falling. Like immediately after this press conference, oil prices started dropping.
So it was effective.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. No, he got results.
All right. To be fair to him, don't you think after coming out on on education spending and he said something about decriminalizing marijuana a couple weeks ago that it's like relaxing to get back to the gas pump?
Well, but putting aside the problems that this is bad policy.
Sure.
All right. Because it's bad policy. We should be raising the gas tax. The gas tax is hasn't been raised in something like 30 years.
Yeah.
And so it's
lower than all of the Western European countries.
And there's nothing more than we need is to raise the gas tax for numerous reasons.
Yeah.
So it's bad policy, but it was also impacted in California. I mean, about how just sort of how much of the tin ear this is in terms of not just, I mean, you've talked about it, the implications, it's a tin ear on a national level.
Yeah.
But even on a more macro, a micro level,
right,
like in California.
Yeah, the politics of this. So in California, which the entire government is run by the Democrats, and the Democrats just raised the California gas tax in order to pay for much-needed infrastructure repairs and in order to build more mass transit. Like, this is good policy. This is what Democrats should be doing when they win power in states. And of course, because California has ballot initiatives, Republicans, bankrolled by rich people, have put a ballot initiative or are trying to get the signatures to put a ballot initiative on to repeal this gas tax increase. And they're hoping that getting this ballot initiative on will boost Republicans' chances in the midterm elections. So to have the leader of one of the leaders of the National Democrats out there complaining about the high price of gas is not like it's also actively harmful to Democrats trying to hold a majority and actually govern.
Right. So not only is it not effective, it is a net negative in a myriad of ways. Not even on a policy. We're just talking like even if you're talking about pure politics, right? So these are just really bad politics. Let's go through a little bit of what Chuck Schumer has also done on top of this, because it seems to me it starts, I mean, early on when Chuck was like, I'll go and meet with Donald Trump and, if there's an infrastructure bill I like and this and that. A month later, it looked like, okay, that was the smart thing to do.
Yeah.
It made it seem like he was going to be reasonable and then Trump wasn't. But I actually think he was foiled as opposed to...
I think you're right, yeah.
That he planned something. I think he, because come December of 2017, do you remember this? Remind people, because he completely lets the Republicans off the hook.
You mean with the shutdown and
yes,
yeah. And so I think you're right, which is that like the cynical way of doing it would have been like, well, we tried to work with Trump, but we couldn't do it. But like, make a show of working with him. I think Chuck is like, I'm a New York guy. He's a New York guy. Like, and also he thought he could outsmart him. He thought he could roll him. But like, what he didn't, you know, this is the thing that people have learned over and over again, is that Trump and the White House, quote unquote, are not the same thing. So if Chuck Schumer goes in to Trump and says, let's make a deal on Dreamers, let's make a deal, and Trump is like, all right, sure, you got a deal, like he leaves the room, and Stephen Miller walks in the room,
right,
and says, well, no, we are not making a deal, and that's it, that kills it. And so Schumer, I think, was like, I can work with this guy personally, and didn't understand the politics of it, didn't understand just sort of the structural barrier to like actually getting a deal done with this White House. I think that's like...
But I just want to put a fine point on this. If you go back and look at the coverage in November of 2017, the amount of stories, I think people could just Google like legislative apocalypse in November of 2017, because the Republicans were looking at like five different things. They were like the debt ceiling, yep, they couldn't pass a budget because it was in the wake of, I think, some other, I can't remember which hurricanes it was or which massive storms, and they couldn't get the funding for that with the budget, mm-hmm, and they wanted to split it off, but they couldn't do that. And there was two or three other deadlines that were coming up. I can't remember if it was S-CHIP or something.
It was S-CHIP.
And the Republicans and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer walked over to the White House and basically said, we're going to take 25 to 40% of what you got, or even 50, maybe it was 60% in terms of like difficulty, off the table.
Yeah.
We're going to clear that up for you. And that's why they ended up getting the tax cuts, in my estimation, because they weren't in total disarray going forward. I think they were worried about the resolutions expiring, and they totally messed it up.
Yeah.
They totally messed it up. And since then, he's done a ton of things like this, it seems to me.
Yeah.
What can I do to help?
No, I mean, Republicans, especially when it comes to things like continuing resolutions and budgets, they can't govern without Democratic help because their own Freedom Caucus members blow everything up. So like, that's the built-in leverage Democrats should have. Pelosi's usually been a little better about navigating this, but like Schumer, I think you're right. Like, they went in and said, all right, we'll help you out, we'll do this, because their instinct, Democrats' instinct, is always like, well, let's at least make sure government's running properly, which, great. But then, you know, it allows for Republicans to actually implement their agenda. But so Schumer, since then, you know, in the interest of helping Trump govern, he's, you know, allowed Trump to have his CIA chief approved, and he's allowed Trump to have his Secretary of State approved, and like all these other things that are like, he could have held up and gummed up the works if he had wanted to.
There was multiple ways where they could have done it. They could have done it where he could have tried to whip votes against them.
Yep.
I mean, if Chuck Schumer can't get Mark Warner to vote against certain things, then there's a real problem, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Because Mark Warner is not like, you know, this is not Joe Lieberman, supposedly.
Yeah.
I mean, let me ask you this. As you go and report, what do you hear in terms of other senators? And because I've heard that certainly former senators are... think that Schumer's really screwing up.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you don't have to look that far to see hints that some former Harry Reid people are not thrilled with how he's doing. And Reid, and I think a lot of people on the left sort of never liked Reid that much, but he knew how to play the game. Like, he absolutely did, in a way that Schumer is not showing that he does. And like, there's an interesting alternate history is like, how would Reid have navigated this first Trump term? Because I think it would look totally different on the Senate side.
I think it would look totally different. And I think we may not even have those tax cuts, to be honest.
Yeah, we might not. Like, it might have been a complete legislative failure, but...
It's a real problem.
Is that Schumer knowing less than Reid? Or is it his actual sort of politics or instincts are different?
I think that he... I don't know. I think it's a couple of things. Because I don't have any sense. Reid is almost a McConnell-like figure in that I don't have any real sense of what his personal politics are. But he seemed to just want political success. And
hates Republicans and supposedly doesn't like to cut Medicare or Social Security.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. But Schumer, I mean, first of all, Schumer seems much more concerned with his own personal image and his own personal brand than Reid ever was. Yeah. And as, maybe just much more limited in his thinking. Like, that's what, like, something like the gas prices thing, just to me, just smacks of someone who has an incredibly narrow vision of politics. Just very, very narrow and provincial idea of politics.
Well, he literally says he has a made-up family that lives in Massapequa that he runs policy by. Says a lot.
Yeah. That's his favorite. He
literally
says
that. That's not in
And I would bet that's probably like the area where he polls the worst. And so he decides that's where my family, made up family is going to be.
Schumer.
This is exactly the problem with his politics is that, he has a made up family from Massapequa. He calls them the Baileys. They're a, you know, a boomer couple. They used to be called the O'Reillys, but then when he was writing a book, he de-Irished them to make them more national.
I'm sorry, the Baileys?
Yeah.
I mean, Bailey's is pretty Irish,
That's
too.
Still pretty. It could be English, though, right?
I don't. You know, New York has changed, where Jews are not as much of a problem on Long Island.
But they live in Massapequa.
It's a new city. It's a new state.
But in his imagination, he runs all of his idea. He runs all of his political calculations through this well-off homeowning couple in a nearly all-white Long Island town. And he's like, what would they think of what I'm about to do?
MS-13 is terrible, but get in front of the gas pump, Chuck.
Yes, no, exactly.
Immediately.
We're driving out to Montauk this weekend, and we want...
I mean, part of the problem could be is that the Baileys, neither Mr. or Mrs. Bailey, has ever spent any time in the Senate. And so their ability to be the Senate leader is probably minimal.
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
He probably goes like, how should I get my caucus to do this? And they go, what do you mean caucus?
You mean like the Baileys don't know how to whip votes? Like, I asked them how to kill the Haspel nomination. They had no ideas. Right. What am I supposed to do?
Chuck, we keep telling you, we don't understand Senate rules. Yeah. They're so Byzantine that so is anybody like actively, are you hearing anybody actively talk about any type of challenge to his leadership?
I not really. And I think that, I mean, I haven't heard anything. Some people are dissatisfied. I feel like the Senate, that's much rarer in the Senate than it is in the House. In the House, there's challenges to leadership pretty regularly.
Not terribly effective.
Not terribly effective, but at least people talk about it pretty openly on Democrats and Republican side. In the Senate, it just seems like, because of the norms of that body, people do not openly be like, we gotta replace this leader. Like, even Mitch McConnell, who's pretty widely hated by the right for crazy reasons, does not have a lot of threats.
But he's insulated because I think everybody in the Senate, I think like anybody who has any type of savvy or like, you know, is hewed to the, you know, the sort of the classic Republican agenda, right, where the money is, he's got to be very happy with Mitch McConnell.
Oh, of course,
right? I mean, he got the tax cuts. He's doing, he's getting every, the judiciary is done. I think Corey Robin had a comment the other day about how this Republican Party is actually the least populist it's ever been. Yeah. Trump may be a populist. You know, that's where the votes may be coming. But in terms of what they're doing, it's all based upon, you know, the judiciary and sort of Senate machinations.
It's based on building in an undemocratic infrastructure to like keep their agenda in place.
Like
exactly.
Permanent oligarchy.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And let me ask you this. What is your sense if there was to be someone in the Senate now who would be a better leader, is there one?
That's a great question. And I don't know. I mean, I know there are senators I like more. I don't know if they are cut out for leadership. It might be, I mean, you know, again, with the problem we run into with congressional Democrats is they've done such a poor job of, I guess, grooming younger generations of leadership,
right.
You know? So it's like you have these people basically 70 years old who've been there a long time, and then a lot of people in the middle who have not really made much of a name for themselves. So I mean it's an interesting question to ask, like who would be a better minority leader, and you know, I don't actually know.
That is a like I think a society wide problem that the boomers their shadow cast over basically my generation. Because there was no room for you to squeeze in. Like there was a slight moment of like cultural, and I think that's a widespread problem.
Do you have frankly. Any ideas in mind?
The only person I have ever heard people talk about, and I have no idea what the skill set is that you would need to do this, I've heard people talk about Jeff Merkley, who would assume is too to the left, right? But another guy, fairly soft spoken. You know, that was the thing about Harry Reid is that you know people would look at him and they would talk about you know I think Limbaugh used to call him Dirty Harry. And then you would see, like, which conjures up an image of Clint Eastwood with a gun, and then Harry Reid would sit there, and he looks like, you know, he looks like.
I asked somebody once who didn't know who Harry Reid was. I was like, "What do you think this guy does?" And they go, "I don't know, pediatrician."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, literally, and he would just sit there and just look meekly, and you knew that he had like a 16-inch blade underneath the table.
Exactly.
And he was, Merkley has that sort of quality too, I think, on some level. But here's the thing: why I think I heard someone suggest this. He was the only senator to endorse Bernie Sanders. Yet he did not alienate anyone else in the Senate because of it.
Yeah,
and he managed to sort of like walk that line.
Yeah,
which was which suggests that the guy has the ability to both sort of like. Maintain relationships and to, you know, still present some type of perspective.
Well, one of the things about the culture of the Senate, and I think it's one of the things that's sort of destructive about it as an institution, is that absolutely those personal relationships matter more than ideology. And I think, like, you look at the hatred in the Senate for someone like Ted Cruz, and it's not ideological. They just don't like him.
Right.
And like,
fair enough.
And comedy... with a T, beats everything else. And so you could definitely have a fairly, I think, left-wing Democratic leader as long as they respected those personal relationships, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of it. I mean, maybe that's why, you know, I don't know whether or not he has the mind that one needs to sort of, you know, play this chess game out. But this sort of dovetails a little bit with that Chait Leffitz, I don't want to call it a debate, but it's out there, where Jonathan Chait had written a piece basically saying that the left was problematic. That is not a new theme of his, probably one that he's been writing about. I don't know when the first time I ever interviewed you, but it was probably at least a decade ago.
Yeah.
And it was... Chait was well into that theme for many years. But the twist is that he was promoting the democracy movement, which is the first time I've ever heard of that movement.
And
there's a new organization, I think, that started where Bill Kristol has signed on and Benjamin Wittes and...
Yeah, and they're like the Pritzkers are behind it. Yeah,
yes, and huge Democratic money, ostensibly to save our democracy from Donald Trump. And that the idea is we got to be nonpartisan and just focus on saving our democracy. Put our agendas aside and focus on this... On this democracy movement. And Eric Leffitz wrote, well, you know, the real danger to our democracy is all of the way American capitalism, I think he puts it.
Yes.
And which I think he would also define as, at this point, highly monopolistic, completely, there's a disequilibrium. Labor has no power. I think you could also say, you know, capital has far too much power.
Two-tier justice system.
Yes.
Because of it.
I mean, all the problems that we see with American capitalism today. He says that's a bigger threat to democracy. And the real problem with these norms movement is that you got to vote for Chuck Schumer and Democrats to take over the Senate and then say, send us your nominees. You know, President Trump, we're not going to filibuster them. We're not, we're going to give them hearings. Like, you've got to do all the things that I think a lot of Democrats, even Democrats, you know, if you go to your average Democrat and say, hey, do you hope that if the Democrats take over the Senate, that
they restore norms? They like.
But even like restore norms, they're going to be like, well, maybe.
Sure, yeah.
But if you say like they're going to seat that first justice that comes through, they're not going to do any payback for this stuff. I think yeah. Now the Democrats would say that's insane.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's one of the things about, I guess, asymmetrical partisan warfare is that, you know, I can easily foresee, if the Democrats retake the Senate, them bringing back the blue chip, the
blue slip,
blue slip. I mean, the blue slip thing, which is where if a home state senator of either party objects to a judicial nominee, they get to put a hold on it, which is a long-standing tradition.
Ron Johnson did it for one guy who just got seated for 7-8 years or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and Republicans have just finally, after threatening to for a long time, finally gotten rid of it.
Yep.
And they did that because, you know, they actually know what's at stake and they want to fill the judiciary. And so when Senate Democrats retake power, like, are they going to bring that back? Like, if there's a Democratic president, will they be respecting that? Will they be respecting that norm again? Because if so, this is, I think, what Chait always tries to posit the left as being anti-democratic. But in this instance, the norm would be upholding an anti-democratic principle, which would be installing a judiciary that doesn't reflect the will of the people.
Right.
That a sort of neo-Lochner judiciary consensus that would like hold back what people collectively want to happen.
Right. The result would be anti-democratic.
Yes.
A. Yeah. B. Also, I got to say, blue slips. That's not exactly a democratic no. institution,
no.
right? The idea of letting one senator from any state to inhibit the federal judiciary, I don't really see the democratic aspects of that
at all.
Yeah. Are you guys having the same thought process now of Chuck Schumer explaining to the Baileys what the blue slip law
right, exactly.
what the rule is okay. and trying Let to run it by them?
Right. But the other thing that really struck me about Chait's thing, which I thought was the aside from the sort of like, I think just the wrongheadedness of the argument, was what made it really disingenuous to me was like, okay, if the premise is this is a democracy movement, then you should be writing this piece about Mark Warner and about Heidi Heitkamp and about Joe Manchin and all the Democrats who have been complicit in allowing Donald Trump to do anything. Like, it's not if you don't want to make it about partisanship, fine. But why are you voting to confirm any of these justices? Why are you even showing up?
Aziz Rana would not have voted for any of those nominees.
No. I mean, why are you even showing up at this point, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, Chait is always fighting. Chait is fighting a battle for what the Democratic Party will look like in the future, and he wants to keep people to his left out of it. So, like, that's the subtext of all of these things he writes. It's about delegitimizing the left, the sort of left wing argument. And I mean, what I find very absurd about it is he's calling writers like Jed Purdy anti-democratic, small d anti-democratic, when like. Someone like that's actual agenda is the expansion of small-D democracy everywhere.
Right.
And, like, I think people sort of in that cohort, like, who are social Democrats or democratic socialists, believe that a much more democratic country would look much more the way they would like it to than our current system. And I think it's unfair of Chait to sort of take what is a political argument and then accuse people to his left of being undemocratic or anti-democratic.
Right. And the interesting thing is that I think there are Democrats to his right who, if they just parsed out this notion of, wait, you want Chuck Schumer to get in there and okay all of Donald Trump's, I mean, you just need to be a partisan Democrat.
Never mind
where you are on the ideological spectrum
to
think that his argument is ridiculous, right? I mean, are there really a lot of Democrats out there who are happy with Mark Warner? No, I don't well, think so.
Because
so.
Someone like Mark Warner, his calculation is always just that he can get away with it. Not that what he's doing is... Like with the bank deregulation stuff, there's no constituency for bank deregulation in the Democratic Party, and there's barely a constituency in the Republican Party.
Right.
He just knows, I can get away with this. Like, and it won't... Like, there's just not enough of a media infrastructure in place to punish me for it, and the populists don't have enough power to punish me for it. So, you know, I'll get... reelected probably.
That's right. A very Maoist style of argument.
Mission accomplished. Shade's
next piece right there.
Now, let me ask you this, because it is the case that you and I have been talking about this for a long time. I mean, particularly Jonathan Chait beating up on the left. And it's funny because now he's had it's an awkward time for him.
Yeah.
Because I think he really had to shoehorn that in. Yeah. And other times it's been easier.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You're right. I mean, other times it's been easier. Like, you don't understand what's at stake in Iraq. Or, you know, you're being irresponsible and you're going to cost us the election.
Yeah.
He doesn't have those things to go to anymore.
Right.
But it also occurs to me that not only is it more awkward for him based upon the era, but also there's less... There seems to be less resonance for that. I mean, dramatically less, right?
Yeah.
I mean, speak to that just for a moment, because I'm surrounded by people who, you know, during the Bush years, for the most part, were either in junior high or, you know, or just high or I'm not naming any names.
Waterboat, dude.
I was straight edge.
But it really has been sort of extraordinary, hasn't it? Like where the center of at the very least the Democratic Party has moved.
That's what's really interesting is there's less of an appetite for that bashing the left style of argument. I think people are less convinced that of the idea that we need to suppress the left in order to win with moderates. Like, people are kind of fed up with that. And you even a writer like Eric Levitz, I don't know him super well, but I think he used to be much more sort of in the center of the Democratic Party. And I think the situation has moved him contextually to a point where he's arguing against American capitalism as causing these problems. And Chait just sort of remains stubbornly where he is. But so when you look at, it's all been very well documented, but people like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker are trying to sound not like the people they were elected as originally.
Right.
People they were elected as originally were a straight shooting law and order prosecutor and a very business friendly mayor who was with the help of finance. Was going to fix government.
Big charter school guy.
Yep. And that's not how they talk. Regardless of what you want to say, their actual agenda is secretly or not. That's just not how they're sounding anymore. And they're jumping on big, substantive left-wing
job
proposals.
Guarantee pilots. Cory Booker is still the only U.S. senator who has a job guarantee proposal on the books.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Still is the only one.
No, which is wild. I should be clear.
I don't think that's who he is.
Sure.
But the idea that he has to project that, I think, is very helpful.
Yes. Yeah. And it's this is what we're here in New York, this gubernatorial election. This is what we're seeing here, too, where it's a man who was elected twice. As governor on the platform of I'll work with Republicans to get a middle of the road way of doing things. He's no one can match my record of progressive accomplishments.
Right.
And I think, Chait would
and
maybe.
And he's also black now.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. He's an immigrant. He's undocumented.
Immigrant. Yep.
Yeah. It's, he's everything.
Yeah. He is all things combined in one man.
So, and I think there's a lot of work to be done, obviously, but I think it's hard to say that it's really hard to say the left is causing problems for the Democrats when the Democrats are jumping to co-opt it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I remember having, just talking about how people were afraid to identify as liberal.
Oh, yeah.
Not because it would be out of fashion to the right, But because it was considered too toxic, because you were saying you were of the left.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, liberal was not a word in the early aughts
no.
that anyone would identify. In fact, the word progressive was introduced to mean liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But people were afraid of using liberal because, basically, since Dukakis.
In the early 2000s, the only time people would self-identify with liberals is when they were making a case for invading Iraq. Right. Like, they would be as a liberal, like, even right. I know right. we exactly. should. Right. Even I know we need to topple Saddam Hussein.
Right.
But in any other circumstance, you would never self-identify.
Never self-identify in that way. I mean, you would run from that all the time. And yeah. I think that started, and within the course of 15 years, people passed through that to like, oh, I'm not a liberal, but I mean, it's fascinating. But I don't know if anything can be done about Chuck Schumer, but I really think it's a huge, huge problem and a massive missed opportunity. Yeah, that's basically what
we can get to the Baileys have like a Bernie bro son.
Baileys have a kid who starts reading the Jacobin.
Here's the thing.
That's how it will work.
If your name is Bailey
and you live in Massapequa,
you have a job.
Please email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We need to talk. We need to put together a video. You need to send a message to Chuck Schumer that he needs to. I don't think it's
Can you imagine that? I'd be like, Chuck, why are you condemning Israeli forces killing a Palestinian baby? I would never want to do it, but the Baileys insisted. Can't kill Palestinian babies anymore.
There you go.
What's the gas tax in Israel?
Well, that's what he said about, that's what he made that point about, that he was blaming the crushing of the
Iran. Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. He was like, gas prices, his argument was gas prices are too high because Donald Trump threw out the Iran nuclear deal, which Chuck Schumer opposed the Iran nuclear deal. He was an ardent opponent of it.
It's also awesome because there's thousands of reasons to support that.
I wonder
deal.
If somebody
he
on his staff
like the one. Like,
I wonder if there was someone on his staff that said, "Senator, you didn't oppose. I mean, you opposed this deal, don't you? Aren't you worried about that?" No one's going to pay attention.
Yeah. The Baileys told me it was fine.
I'm just putting it. Listen, okay. We're going to put it up on the website.
Yeah, we'll put
and if it comes back up again, we can say that I did it. It's all right.
It's fine. What is everybody so worried about?
The democracy move, what?
Don't I get credit for helping him ease through his agenda?
All right, we're going to take a quick break. If you want... If you can, stick around.
I can stick around, sure.
Okay, stick around for a little bit. You can leave at any time you want. It's the way they work. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to, when we come back, we're going to be talking to Jake Flores. He is a comedian, but most well known, at least to me, because I don't go to comedy clubs anymore. I'm sorry, folks. He also has a podcast, apparently, and is a pizza delivery guy. Who tweeted out something about ICE. And they were so impressed by his tweet, they visited him. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jake Flores.
To wait 5 years. feel this and do not. It's it on my hands.
We are back. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com for just several pennies, well, several dimes a day. Several dimes a day. You keep this show continuing. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you the fun half, wherein we have fun. And again, if you can't afford it, but want access to the fun half, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and then wait for 2 weeks and then we'll hook you up. Now it is my pleasure to welcome the program. We still have Alex Perrine of Splinter News, editor of politics at Splinter News, here with us. Of course, Michael and Brendan and Matt are here. But I'd like to welcome to the program Jake Flores. He is a comedian, also a co-host of maybe my favorite named podcast.
That's a good one.
Pod Damn America.
good afternoon.
Hi, Jake. Welcome to the program. And I should say that I first heard about your story from Splinter News, which mm-hmm. I had forgotten, of course. But okay, before we get into you telling us about yourself, well, actually, why don't you tell us about yourself? You're a comedian. You host Pod Damn America. What happens on Pod Damn America?
I started Pod Damn America about a year ago after Charlottesville kind of went down, and I found myself, doing what I do as a comedian. I've been doing stand-up for, a little over a decade now, and it's kind of been, I think, for a long time, but also, I'm heavily involved in a sort of burgeoning leftist movement that's happening in America right now, and I'm invested in it, and so I found myself sort of writing a lot and sort of, using platforms like Facebook and Twitter to kind of put information out that I thought was important, but then I sort of realized we're kind of publishing stuff. I mean, algorithm just fades whatever you're writing away. So I started as a project to just sort of, be a part of sort of the new left, because in my opinion, like, it's not a new idea. I mean, I kind of aped like what Chapo Trap House is doing and those types of people that are, huge and successful. I just kind of thought that, if we're going to have an actual left movement in this country, there should be like as many leftist comedy outlets as there are straight up liberal comedy outlets, it shouldn't be like a singular idea. So I kind of thought of it as just, doing my part and throwing in my little area of expertise into the ring, I started off by doing some episodes about Antifa because I just noticed that suddenly this thing that I kind of know about was in the news. Nobody else knew about it. So, we started from there, and we figured out a way to make it funny and make it kind of interesting and, just doing what I can, I suppose.
Sounds good. And so you tweeted something out. Now, I know that there's a, sort of a danger of people who are comedians tweeting things can sometimes get you in trouble.
So I hear, Sam.
I've had my own experience with that. But with that said, I think what went down with you is a lot scarier than what went down with me, frankly. Let me read this tweet of yours from May 5th, 2018. And you write, okay, here's how Cinco de Mayo works in 2018. White people are allowed to culturally appropriate on the condition that you help destroy ICE. You kill one ICE agent and you get to wear a sombrero. Two kills and you get to wear a poncho.
But we didn't appreciate that. If you're angry at the policy, blame Congress.
Now, so So now, Jake, was it some type of joke?
Oh, absolutely not.
Do I hear knocking on your door again?
Yeah, we listen to the Majority Report. That Jewish guy. And,
can we put the scroll? Can we put the scroll underneath here? Everything is satirical that we're talking about. Please, can we just drop that scroll right underneath? All right. So you tweet this out on Cinco de Mayo. Did you have other Cinco de Mayo tweets or other tweets talking about ICE?
Probably. I was kind of on an ICE kick that day, you know. that was probably the big one. I was doing a lot of a bit I came up with was drinking these big cans of Bud Ice and yelling "Abolish ICE" while I drink them. That was pretty fun. you know, just dumb stuff like that.
That sounds like something that like they would maybe even contemplate using as an online campaign. I feel like that's like the teens version of Waza. Dude, where's my beer? I abolished all the ice.
Yeah, that's fine.
You can have all this stuff too, incidentally. I'm not. all right. So you tweet it out, and how does it do? Does it get? Do you get a lot of retweets on this? Do you get like? What was your ratio?
So it was kind of interesting because you know I'm an extremely online millennial, you know, so I just tweet every other thought that comes into my brain, and I use the internet as sort of a scratch pad. Like I was using this as a way to remember it, so I could work it out as a bit later on. Which now, with the whole thing that happened, I got a great fucking 12 minutes out of it. Sorry, can I curse? Sorry.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, cool. So what's interesting though is that it was pretty well received. Like I didn't have anyone directly respond to me and say anything negative. Like I got retweets, I got shares on Facebook. Everyone kind of laughed. A couple of people went, "Whoa," you know, like you're playing the fire there. But nobody really came at me, and the post didn't get taken down, which leads me to believe that it probably didn't get reported by another user. Because when you get reported by another user, the platform flags the post. Because now it's a liability, right?
But you seem to have had some experience with this. Is that?
I mean, it was clearly totally different from the other times when I personally pissed somebody off directly, because you know.
I mean, yes, though. Like, this is part of my job, you know?
Hell yeah.
And so, you know, nothing happened until 9 a.m. the next day when the feds kicked on my door. And
Wait a second. Wait. You gotta ease into this. So you're sitting there. So, all right. You're now, I assume if you're a comedian, it's 9 a.m., you're asleep, right?
Oh, my, yes.
Okay. So you're asleep, and I assume also you don't have a kid or anything like that, so you're totally asleep. And what? And how does like, do you get a doorbell knock? Is it a buzzer? Somebody slide a note under your door? What happens?
Okay, so this is kind of pertinent to the story. I don't live in a regular apartment. I live in a loft, which is like a punk house situation. It's of a factory in a part of Brooklyn that is not really residential, and nothing's labeled. It's really hard to get into the building. When I order food on Seamless, you know, they don't know where it is. Like I have to come downstairs, because even if they get inside, which they can't, there's no numbers on the doors or anything. There's graffiti everywhere and stuff. And so it's very odd that they found me within a day. And
all right, well, no, wait, Jake, now, is this door. Like, is it like a squatter situation? I mean, or do you not want to, let's skip that.
it's not, it's called Loft Law. It's just, you're allowed to live in an art studio, basically, in New York, until they destroy this law in a year or two.
Oh, right, exactly.
But it's a semi.
Do you get your mail there?
Yeah, I get mail, usually get stuff sent to wherever I'm working, though, because it's very reliable, because there's all sorts of crazy, you know, people running in and out all the time and males. Technically, it works, but you know, it's not that reliable.
I'm just curious as to how did they track down? How did they track you down?
I don't know, and I mean, this does raise a lot of questions about like the surveillance state and like cell phones and things like that. Because like, not only do they know, you know, where I lived, they knew I would be there, which I'm not always there. You know, I mean, like traveling around, I often don't sleep at home. You know,
nice.
My guess would be my phone, but anyone's. Say, I suppose, and they also could have just talked to, I don't know, like the people that own the building or something. I mean, there is record of me being there. It's not a complete plot or anything, but it's odd that they were able to pull it off that quickly.
So they're knocking on, they've got into the building somehow, and they're knocking on your apartment door, loft door, and do they just knock? I mean, what do you, like, what? Do people knock on your door at 9 a.m. often? Is that the first time that's ever happened?
People don't knock on my door is the thing. Like, this is not an apartment where people are walking around, you know, asking each other for cups of sugar and stuff like that. I woke up and, you know, there's this loud banging on the door. And so I would not have answered it, honestly, if I didn't think it was a repair guy. I just waiting for this guy to show up and fix this leak I had in my ceiling. I mean, there's pipes leaking all over the place, rats everywhere. There's a window fell out of the week before this. So I kind of just assumed in my groggy, hungover state that, oh, it's the repair guy, you know? And I opened the door, lo and behold, four DHS agents. They say Department of Homeland Security. I think one of them holds up a badge. And from there, I'm a little groggy on like what happened. Cause,
well, wait a second, what are they wearing? Tell me what they're wearing. I'm curious. Were they wearing those like Parkers that have like DHS on the back, or what? Did they have any? What were they wearing? They're just wearing suits.
Not suits, just like kind of dorky button downs and stuff like that. You know, they look like nerds.
Did you tell them that? You know,
Carrie Matheson, Mandy Patinkin on Homeland. You know, just professional garb.
I didn't know. I was like such pussies.
So wait a second. So casual Friday stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
It was the weekend, you know, for them too.
Wait, this is on a Sunday?
Jesus Christ.
What day was it? Was it a Sunday?
It was a Sunday morning. Santa Maya was Saturday. Sunday morning was the next day.
Well, at least
all the scary ICE agents had the weekend off.
That's right. Yeah, I guess tax dollars at work. At least they're on tour.
So you should have known it's not the repair guy because he never comes on time on a weekend.
That's how they break it. That's how they break out the assignment. Like, all right, the actual guys, you've got some families to destroy upstate.
Right.
The ones you don't look intimidating at all. You should go terrorize this comedian kid off of Twitter.
Yeah, basically.
So, okay, so the four guys come in, and they just look dorky. They're dressed like the dad on some type of sitcom or, like, you know, right?
Is no, he said Carrie and Mandy Patinkin. Yeah. Okay, that worked well.
So what happens? Do you invite them in? Do you sit down at your table? Do you have a table in your apartment?
Yeah. Okay, so here's how this goes down, right? They sort of, you know, they throw me off. I open the door. So they're Homeland Security. And I can't remember whether like, they just came in or I went like, all right, whatever. Let's just do this. And a lot of people will come at you with these sort of like libertarian, like, you know, you should have said, am I being detained and all this stuff. do you have any experience with actual police? You know, they don't honor that stuff in the moment. Like, you kind of just have to do what they're going to do and then figure that stuff out in court later, you know?
Did you know why they were there?
I'm sorry?
Did you know why they were there? Like, did you go like, oh, it's that tweet that I had about ICE?
I figured it out pretty quick because they mentioned something about ICE. They, like, asked me about ICE. And then also another part of this that kind of, I think they kind of maybe were trying to intimidate me on some level, like, wake you up, right? The thing is, I was out till 6 in the morning, so I was still drunk. Like, I was like, whatever, let's do this. But also, this happened to a pal of mine, like, 2 years ago. Nick Mullen got the FBI called on him. And Nick Mullen, if you don't know, is your friend, your friend Mike Cernovich thinks Nick Mullen is the head of the DSA.
President. Is that true?
Yeah, he tweeted out this, the DSA Mike had a conference. Yeah. The DSA had a conference.
Who's laughing now, Nick?
I do like the guys who are like who have never dealt with anything in their lives, and they would say like, what you do when federal agents show up at your place at 9 o'clock in the morning is you say, according to Article 2, Section 5, Bill of Rights, and then they can't enter your domicile, dude. What the hell is the matter with you?
I will not be quartering soldiers here.
I know.
I don't recognize the federal government. Yeah. I am a citizen of the state of New York. So wait,
I'm a resident of this art shed, sir. Yeah.
So they start talking about ICE, but it's not until they mention ICE that you think this is about the tweet. So you don't know immediately. You're just like, must have been something I did. What, like, are there other things that you felt like you did that might have like had DHS at your door?
Honestly, I figured it out pretty quick. I mean, I don't really know what else I could have done. I'm kind of a scumbag, but I'm not really, like, up to anything. I don't really think there's anything else that would have crossed my mind. I'm like, oh, my God, what did I, you know, did I get away with this thing in my past? I mean, on some level, I think their, you know, their job is to intimidate you a little bit. They're an arm of the authoritarian apparatus, you know? But I found myself in a unique situation because when the government comes to knock on your door, you know, if you have kids or something, it's terrifying because you don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
They may tear you away from your kids, right? But I'm a shitty comedian. Like, I don't have anything. So I just, you know, I was like, oh, I got nothing to lose. I'm so hungover. I don't care if I die right now. You know?
Did you say this to them? Everything. I don't know. Are you quoting yourself?
You can't blackmail me. I've been actively trying to get famous for 10 years, you know? Right. It doesn't matter. So I
it's like, as I see it, you're either going to kill me or this is a major uptick in my Twitter following.
Right. Yeah. Like, either I'm dead or this is the best thing that's ever happened.
There's two ways to play this. Capital One murder, like, which we're not quite at yet for Twitter jokes, or you just Dave me a great favor, guys.
So, all right. So they start talking to you, and what do they say?
Well, you know, they start talking to me about the ICE thing, and, you know, the first thing I do is we're standing around, and I go, one of them's like, should you sit down? And I go, yeah, sure, we'll sit down at my table. I have this table in my, like, loft space, the living room, where I record my podcast, right? And the table's got all these microphones set up at it. Sit down. The main guy looks at the microphone and he goes, are these things recording? And I go, no. And he believes me. And they weren't recording, but like, what kind of government agent are you? You
don't even check. Me. Well, first of all, I think we've all learned a great lesson today. If you have a table full of microphones and there's a knock at your door, turn on the recording device.
You know what would be funny? You know what I love? You know, like those old infomercials with the clap? You're like, 1 second. Now they're off.
So he says, okay,
so
good.
He starts asking me.
Do they sit down at that point?
I'm sorry?
Do they sit down after you've assured them that the microphones are off?
Yeah, so we sit down, me and the main guy, right? So there's this main guy, and then there's these three other guys. And the three other guys don't have cameras. And what they're doing is they're going around my apartment taking photos and, I guess, building a case file on me, which is, that's kind of interesting. There's just a file on me now.
They're
filing lots of people. It's interesting to know, you know? I know people who are in, like, J20 and stuff that know they have a file and et cetera. But, like, what is going on in this file with me? Because, you know, for one thing, they're taking pictures of all the art on the walls, and it's not my stuff. I have this roommate who was like super goth and weird and just like, you know, made the place look like a corn video, and then she moved out and all that stuff is still there. I'm talking to this guy and I'm like, don't read into the art on the walls. It's not part of my whole thing, you know. I'm not this like weird The Crow terrorist guy, you know. But he asks me eventually about, you know, about ICE and about the tweet or whatever. And I tell him, like, I know you know who I am. You looked me up. Clearly you know I'm a comedian. You know I'm joking. So what we're talking about here is, you know, how do we deal with jokes? Because if I had written a novel, you know, some sort of dystopian future thing, it wouldn't be a question. And if I had written a TV show about this, it might have been successful. This sort of stuff is popular right now, you know? Because it's a joke, we have this whole thing where we take them literally and we don't deal with the subtext, context that everyone... Now, everyone who's an adult actually understands when you're clearly joking about something, you know?
Right. Not to mention the fact that you don't have really the official capacity to allow for the cultural appropriation, yes. nor the mechanism to measure it, right? Like, you haven't, right. you're not.
No, he was. He was actually La Raza co-signed. So yeah. It's a deal I have with La Raza, man.
Where are the spreadsheets where you're keeping track of of who's been shot and who gets to culturally appropriate the poncho?
Yeah,
that's what they were taking the pictures for. Silly, they were looking for the abacus where you do all the numbers on it.
Yeah.
The algorithm, you know? So I start talking to him about that, and he goes, like, yeah, you know, it's a good point. I'm like, well, that's a good point. What are you doing in my apartment? Like, you could have sent me an email or something, you know? He starts to go on to the concept of, like, insightfulness, you know? And, well, you know, we know you're joking, but what if the wrong person heard this and took it seriously? Which, by the way, hilarious. Like, I know that's a messed up idea, but if someone, like, did this with their time...
To wear a poncho, that actually, like... they were like, right. This guy on Twitter says I can wear a poncho if...
Yeah. I mean, if that's the standard...
Seems like a high price to pay, but I'm willing
honestly,
to do it.
If that's the standard, when you... You know, Ben Shapiro right now would be in some serious hot water because he apparently, you know, was the number one Twitter read by the guy who killed folks up in Canada at the mosque.
Right.
And, you know, Ben Shapiro's not funny. He's not even trying to make jokes when he says, when he's done all his videos saying, like, this is just a matter of time. Half of all Muslims are radicalized. They're going to kill your family.
Right.
And this guy...
Ignore the corn work.
He doesn't
corn
even have
artem.
The satire crawl.
He doesn't have the satire crawl. He doesn't have any of that.
Ignore the gothic art on the wall, guys.
So I we'll get to how much these free speech guys came to your rescue in a minute. But... So you're saying this with the guy, and the guy says, yeah, I mean, it's a good point, but it's possibly insightful. You may convince somebody out there who is humor challenged to actually do this because they think that they're going to get to wear a sombrero on Cinco de Mayo, and then what?
So when he brings up the insightfulness thing, I ask, like, well, then why aren't you kicking in Alex Jones's door and, like, Roseanne Barr? Because I work... at a pizza restaurant in New York, and we get daily Pizzagate death threats, like a daily. Do you understand it? That's how much power she actually has, and she's not joking. Like, people actually take that seriously, you know? And so, like, they kind of just buck after a while, and they're like, well, fair point. And I'm like, well, you know, well, then why are we having this whole conversation? But it does, you know, beg a lot of questions about free speech, how it's like, is it really free if it's only... selectively enforced, you know, and I think I'm being visited by these people because I, you know, I made fun of the government and these free speech guys that imagine that they're all going to get visited by the government never will because they believe all the same stuff as the government, you know. It's really funny how jealous a lot of these free speech dork comedians probably are over this because this is every comedian's fantasy, you know, you want to be Lenny Bruce or whatever. But anyway, we move on, and we start talking about ICE, and ICE, you know, I ask him a question after a while, because at the end of this, as we start getting near the end of this whole conversation, he asks me if I have any questions for him, like we're in a job interview or something, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, in closing, you know, what are you here to defend? Like, what is the thing that ICE does that you sort of believe in? Because he had started to go into this this logic after a while, this argument of like, well, you know, how many interactions do you think ICE has on a daily basis that don't get taped and put on the internet, yada, yada, yada. And I've talked to a million cops about this. It's the same argument they all use, right, which is that there's some sort of inherent job that the police are doing that is good and for the community and everything, and these videos that we see are designed to make you outraged, and they're, you know, they're only what happens 1% of the time. And I don't believe that argument when it comes to cops, but that's at least a valid argument because at some level the police, you know, it's set to protect and serve and out of their cars, you know. But with ICE, their stated mission is what people are against, you know.
Right.
They're, like,
yeah.
They
right.
shouldn't exist. They're only 10 years old. Like, this is not an age-old institution or anything. So ask him that, and he goes, oh, ICE fights human trafficking. And I'm a bit of I'm a little boned up on this issue called FESTA FOSTA. If you're not familiar, FESTA FOSTA is a bill that passed recently that was sold as fighting human trafficking. In reality, it's extremely anti-woman, extremely pro-patriarchy, extremely anti-sex worker, right?
Well, it's also a net negative in terms of fighting trafficking because it drives it further underground and basically prevents a mechanism that was out there to sort of track where traffickers were.
Exactly. And that's because, it's not actually about sex trafficking. It's about, the people that, the organizations that pushed it to begin with are, right-wing Christian organizations that also don't want Cosmo to be sold, on shelves at supermarkets, right? So this isn't about that. This is about old gender patriarchy stuff. So they use this scapegoat of human trafficking to sell bills like FESTA FOSTA. If you look at everyone who got arrested after FESTA FOSTA, everyone who got arrested was a sex worker who got arrested for sex work, not for trafficking, right? So it's pretty obvious how they use these switcheroos, right? Immediately when he told me that, I was like, I know exactly what you're doing. I know exactly the argument. That's the same bullshit they used to pass FESTA FOSTA, right? And then he comes to me and he goes, what's FESTA FOSTA?
You're ace in the interview.
I was like, all right, everyone sit down, you know, and I started talking about FESTA FOSTA to the Department of Homeland Security, the human trafficking police, you know, which is supposedly this is their job. And after a while, they just kind of looked at each other, wrapped up, and, told me, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll be watching you and you may expect another visit and good luck on your tour. Ha 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 ha, you know, cop humor or whatever. And then I went on with my day, and I told the story to Catherine Kruger over at Splinter. I did Chapo about it and stuff like that.
That's unbelievable. It's amazing too. Those guys have since quit, and they are now actively
Patreon members.
They're Patreon members of Pod Damn America. So, all right, let me ask you this. Do you have any? Have you talked to a lawyer?
Yeah, I've talked to a couple people, some people with the ACLU, et cetera. Probably not as much as I should have. I've got some numbers kind of in my back pocket over, whether this could go extremely south. It's just that I had to leave for a tour immediately after this happened. I already had a tour booked, so I had to go jump in a van and drive across the country. I didn't really have a lot of options for making a huge long-term plan while I was about to be working all day, every day. I don't really know exactly what I even should be preparing for because I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get revisited by these guys. It still is always there in my mind.
I'd just be curious to hear what a lawyer says about this. I mean, I guess when they came to your door, you did invite them in. But
vampire law applies.
But I think the real question is whether or not you have a First Amendment case. Because this is actually, and I'm sure. I'm sure Dave Rubin has reached out to you, and I'm sure you're already booked on the Dave Rubin show, and I'm sure all of these free speech warriors.
He has a right to make jokes, and ICE has a right to respond.
Because
so let's circle the wagons
Here's the fundamental difference between your situation and every other situation that Dave Rubin talks about. It is a free speech question when the government is involved. Period. End of story. If somebody, if a corporation doesn't want you to speak and say something when they hire you, they can fire you right away unless there's any specific legislation against that. But it's only free speech, obviously, when the government is chilling your speech. And I don't know how this could be interpreted in any other way with government agents, literally agents of the government, coming to your apartment after a tweet and saying, you should really think twice about those type of tweets. If they've got a case that you're inciting, they should take you to jail. They should have you go in front of a court and say, this guy's inciting, you know, the death of federal agents. And I think any judge would laugh it out of a courtroom. But yeah, I think there's a First Amendment case here because, I mean...
It's chilling. It's chilling speech.
It's literally the definition.
I guess Ruben would be interested if your pizza place fired you.
That's right.
Then it would be
like just a pizza place. But yeah, like, I mean, I think you should. I mean, I would follow it up with the ACLU, and maybe somebody hears this and you know reaches out to you because it really does seem like a perfect example of the chilling of free speech. I just wonder how many other people this has happened to. Have you heard from anybody else that has been through this experience?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's obviously a much more chilling story about an activist that was jailed for an insane amount of time. There's a story in The Guardian about this guy, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but there was a guy who was jailed and taken away from his family over posts that were, you know, he's not a comedian, but they were
Black Lives Matter
posts
activist.
Oh, I remember that. Said things with a colorful use of language, you know. So there's real, you know, this is really happening. Also, when I was talking to the DHS agent, I asked him, you know, like why he was here, and he said, well, you know, we have had similar cases in the past that have been more insidious. And I asked him if someone was doing my material out there, because that's not okay with me, you know. sorry, I had to slip in a Lenny Bruce joke. Okay, but the thing about this is that you're right. I mean, this is actually a free speech issue in that government is involved. When people talk about, you know, the war on Roseanne or whatever as being a free speech issue, that's not free speech because the government isn't involved. You're exactly right. That's just someone not wanting to, you know, pay you anymore, which they have a total right to do. I am kind of on the fence about whether I want to take this any further because my experience with the police in, you know, the past is if I can make this not a thing, that's better for my general safety. Right. But on the other hand, I mean, if this is, if this is something that could have some sort of positive effect, well, then, yeah, sure, I'll go and make a case out of it and make a story out of it because, you know, it's absolutely true. I just don't know, you know, if I'm super into the idea of risking getting jailed over it.
I can understand that. You don't want the late career Jake Flores to be up doing a 4-hour diatribe reading from court records, a la Lenny Bruce's last.
Yeah, just reading the transcript film. Of his own
yeah,
trial.
Exactly.
I just want to note the story of this Black Lives Matter activist. He was literally imprisoned over a Facebook post. He lost his house, his separated from his children, and ironically, you talked earlier about like who's really inciting things. The information where apparently they said they learned about the protests and what he was doing came from InfoWars content that they watched.
That's right. I remember that detail. Yeah.
Yeah. So think about that circle.
That's just like Project Veritas exactly. Videos being used in the prosecution. J20.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the same dynamic.
Right. That's also another reason why I may not be too keen on taking this case into the heart of the system, because I don't have a lot of faith in the system at this point if, you know, they're getting their information from InfoWars and stuff like that. a dangerous thing to do, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, I just don't know. I totally respect that and appreciate that and understand that. But for folks at home, even that sentiment is indicative of chilling free speech. Yep. I mean, this is not It's a crazy story, and Jake, I really appreciate your sharing it with us. It's going to get a lot more exposure when Ruben has you on his show. I will say that.
Also, can I say one last thing? Actually,
please.
On that note, I do believe that on some level, the job of this branch of the government was to come to me and to intimidate me, and they always do this to comedians, I think, because they think that like the joke is going to be me coming back and going, "Whoa, guys, don't mess with the big bad government." They know exactly what they're doing, and I definitely don't want that to be the message of this, even if I do what I'm going to do one way or the other at the end of the story. I mean, the message of this should be that this is a monstrous thing, you know.
Right.
I don't want the whole reason I did what I did was I thought to myself, well, I'm in a unique position to be able to stand up to this where other people probably couldn't. So, you know, to that degree, I mean, you're right. Maybe the right thing to do would be to go forward with this. I just don't know where it's going to go. But yeah, I definitely don't want to end on a down note here. I mean, fuck all these people.
Right. Jake, it's a great story. I really appreciate it. It's your Twitter handle is at Feral Jokes, which also could have been a tip off to the to the ICE agents.
But that's right. You mean like people should go rabid? Like what's going on?
And your website is feraljokes.com. People can go check out your schedule as you go around. Thanks so much for the time today, Jake. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, folks. And
Jesus
thus,
Christ.
Unbelievable, right?
The thing about having the goth artwork on the walls and the cops are like taking pictures.
And it's in a file somewhere with numbers on it, like all of his roommates' like goth artwork.
I just imagine them trying to like piece that together back at the station and being like really confused.
They've got it all on the bulletin board.
Yeah. Evanescence, what is that?
That's nuts, though. It really is is nuts. And it's indicative. I mean, look, we mentioned this this afternoon or this, you know, earlier in the program. Prosecutors withheld some 50-odd hours. So Project Veritas shot video of the J20 protesters. It was something like 230 who were originally indicted. And these are people who are protesting at the inauguration on January 20th. The cases against about, I guess, 190 of them, about 180 of them were dropped. There's still about 59 cases, I think. And they are arguing that these folks were attempting to incite violence. And apparently, the prosecution has withheld a bunch of those Project Veritas tapes, the raw footage, which include these people explaining to who they think are other protesters, we are not going to do anything violent. We are not going to be in any way physical unless we're attacked. Mm-hmm. Making it absolutely clear that their intention was, in fact, not to be violent. And prosecutors withheld this. This is a case that has obviously been going on. We're in May of 2018. Mm-hmm. This is a case that's been going on for 2 years. I guess maybe a year and a half, right? 2017. At a cost of who knows how much, but also at a cost of, I mean, the First Amendment. Yeah. It really is shocking. I mean, so, you know, there may be something to the so-called democracy movement, except for they're not really looking at the right stuff.
Yeah.
And certainly the leaders, the people most sensitive to this, you would think, would be the elected leadership of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. I mean, I think what is actually one scary thing, and this is something that I think elected Democrats should absolutely be shouting about, except they're always afraid of sounding anti-cop. But it's terrifying when law enforcement agencies are essentially taking their assignments from the conspiratorial right.
Yep.
And that's if you like, there seems to be ample evidence that people with authoritarian tendencies and perhaps conspiratorial thinking are rampant in various law enforcement agencies. And if Project Veritas and InfoWars are telling them where to go looking for things to investigate, that's actually terrifying. And Democrats should like not just be, they should be vocal about that because it's like just for the sake of partisanship, like even not just for the sake of free speech and justice, but like.
I have to run it by the Bailey.
Where are the
No matter where you are on the cynical spectrum of politics to like good policy and you know and democracy up to like it's going to help you win.
Yeah.
The Baileys thought that the joke was a little tasteless, so the First Amendment needs to go.
That I would say is like you know, and we're still waiting on it. I think we're now thinking that we're going to drop the Cernovich documentary, a little bit when he's back online. He seems to be taking a vacation. But the idea is this that, and maybe this is a feature, not a bug for some in certain governmental agencies, but these news outlets that are using the basis that J20 prosecutors are using as the basis, and the ICE case, or I should say, the case against this Black Lives Matter activist, they're a little bit disingenuous. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody's picked up on that, maybe in the U.S. government. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half, wherein we will have fun. We will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. And just a reminder, this show relies on its members to exist. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a thank you, we give you an extra hour or so of programming every day. Again, if you can't afford it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll take care of you. And just a reminder, today is Friday, which means that Tuesday is... I got Saul today to do... to multiply 3 times 2.
Nice.
I was pretty excited
he's
about
crushing
that.
Crushing it.
He's crushing it. And so Friday, Tuesday. Tuesday was several days ago. Right. And
that's true.
He doesn't get the math from me. And on this week's TMBS.
We had on Felix Biederman. We actually did a spec script of Aaron Sorkin's InfoWars. Like newsroom InfoWars.
Oh, right.
Among many other things.
Actually.
That was pretty
not a bad idea.
No, really not.
So good.
We were doing like tracking shots.
I have
of, you
actually,
know, like, you know those.
I'll tell you something. I have been asked for that.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Get Mammoth on.
What are you talking
it.
About? Let's do
I
this.
Have been asked for that.
We were doing like, you know those like really horrible Sorkin, like where two people are walking together
walk and
you're
talk,
just like,
yeah.
You got a JD from Harvard, blah, blah. And it's just like, you got to hit just because you have like an ND in homeopathy from the
the problem. Yeah. The problem with it as
we're not
going to
break the estrogen and Capri story with the same old thinking.
But the problem with I mean maybe now the way television is situated that you could actually do it, but the problem with that show is that it the premise is in and of itself ironic.
Yes.
So it's no. Fair enough. I mean like there was. There was this great pilot that Ben Stiller Company did with Jack Black and with Owen Wilson. Owen Wilson played the voice of a talking motorcycle. It was Heat Vision in Jack is what it was called. And I don't think it never made it to air, but it was I had done something with Stiller's company and they had copies of it. And so Jack Black was like, it was like Kit. It was like that thing, but it was almost a parody of it. Like it wasn't, so it didn't, the audience at the time, now this was like 20 years ago, so you didn't have, you just had, you know, major networks.
Well, the size
audience you needed for a show was much larger.
Right.
Now you can do more niche things.
Now we'll do that on Netflix.
That theoretically. Well, I mean, the other one we were, because I literally was asked for that 6 months ago.
The other one we were shopping around was Martin Scorsese's Pizzagate.
That's also good.
Which I think also has a possibility.
That seems more like a limited run.
Yeah. That would definitely traveled around right-wing YouTube.
How much would that drive?
These guys think pedophilia is funny.
How much do you think Cernovich, it would drive Cernovich crazy if someone else actually made money off of that?
There is a way to make money off of Pizzagate.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Alex, I don't know if you can stay.
I got to run, actually.
Okay. Well, Alex Breen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank really you so much. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Quick break.
I have an announcement, actually.
Oh, wait a second. Yeah, this is important. Shit. Well, you should have told me this earlier.
Well, we can do. We can. There's plenty of time.
We're still on the fun
We
half.
Do this 100 times.
I mean, excuse me.
All right. So hold on for 1 second, because this deserves. This is probably. Yeah, I would say this. Now, special report.
All right, so I am launching a podcast. I launched it last night. It's typically going to be released on the first and third Saturdays of the month. It's called The Literary Hangover. It's a journey through American history using fiction as sort of the jumping off point. So the episode one is The Spy by James Fenimore Cooper. And me and my friend Alex sort of talk about how it represents sort of the revolution and slavery and a lot of different sort of political and historical and social economic sort of things.
So it's a history podcast.
It's sort of like a book club. I want it to be listenable for people who don't actually have time to read the books. And maybe the episodes work as a primer for them to maybe they go back and read the book after they listen to it. So it's.
But it's like it's you're basically like this is. Gives you the ability, if you want to seem well-read,
yes.
that you can go and have a almost graduate-level degree about the book without ever even having reading it.
Exactly.
This is you going to the cocktail party and everybody just walking away going, that man or woman is brilliant.
Yes.
I've read that book and I didn't get that.
It shares some format with kind of this show where I play clips. I play a clip of Gerald Horn's book called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. I play some nonfiction stuff in there. So there's a lot of context and stuff for people to follow along if they, you know, aren't a real big fiction reader.
It's very cool.
I love it.
It's very, very cool.
All right, folks. And that is available on iTunes and it's called what?
Literary Hangover. It's available on iTunes and patreon.com/literaryhangover.
Literary Hangover.
More like literary
paper bomb. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be back in a moment.